From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Today we're going to talk about the recent visit to the city, a second visit by Dimitri Lascaris. He had been in the city previous on a Canada-wide tour, speaking to the issue of how to bring about a peaceful resolution to the current fighting between Russia, Ukraine. And Dimitri, you know, as our listeners will know, has visited Russia. His point there was to encounter a variety of Russian people so that he could get an assessment of their views and also to talk to academics and others who are engaged with the issue. A most helpful project, in our opinion. So we'll be talking about this. He spoke at a public library at I think it's called the Northern Branch. I'm not sure. But anyway, it was Young and Eglinton on Saturday. And Tony Leo attended that. Tony Leo is a Unifor member and also a peace activist over the years. And so we're going to ask for a report on it and maybe what the future is going to hold for activities such as this, and also for the man himself, Dimitri Lascaris, who has really impressed a number of people. And of course, another figure who was present there had been our guest a week ago, Sid Ryan, former president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, and had a long career in CUPE, and he's a remarkable individual. So we're going to find out what Dimitri and Sid had to say. And we will go into other labour matters. We try to focus more and more on this, and of course, the headlines are helping us. We have several big issues. There is the issue of the billions and billions and billions given by the Canadian government, Ontario government, to Volkswagen and a company called Stellantis. And we want to go into that because there's been a lot of confetti in the air and people throwing their hats, and maybe that's premature. And again, Tony Leo will talk about that matter and background. And there is also the Teamsters and the United Parcel Service, which is a potential strike there. We want to hear about that. And the longshore strike in British Columbia, International Longshoremen's Union, and against the I think they're called the Maritime Employers. So those are things we're going to go into. But at the top, I want to just raise an issue, which I think we'll try to do this periodically on the Taylor Report, because it strikes me as very odd. And I was prompted to talk about this by a Toronto Star article in which the author was talking about the situation with Russia, Ukraine, and trying to analyze this phenomenon of the Wagner Group and Mr. Prigozhin. And along the way, he did something which is really common in Western journalism. And he used a phrase which is popularized. I think it came originally into usage from Winston Churchill. He says, there's a Russia, and this problem represents a a mystery wrapped in an enigma, with the notion being that there's something really odd about this other society and this, their culture, and it's really unfathomable the way they operate. And it was a way of mocking, going back to Churchill. I remember that if anybody's read him knows it, this is one of his favorite phrases, and the media picked it up, and they apply it. They also apply it to China, but particularly Russia, saying it, you know, it's something beyond our ken. But we have a situation right now which we really need to talk about a lot, and that is this so-called foreign interference phenomena that has had Canada abuzz for months now. I'm trying to, I didn't get the precise date, but we'll all agree it's been for quite a while. This year we've been had foisted on us the subject of interference, foreign interference, with it being made periodically quite explicit that it was, that it's involves China. And this begins with a source cited by, starting with basically conservative media, the Globe and Mail and a couple of other spots, but and they've been driving the story. And it's all based, you will remember, I should know, it is based on a source allegedly inside CSIS, our intelligence organization, one of them. And politicians have had their, and individuals in Canada have had their careers interrupted, disrupted. There have been resignations from caucuses. Like a member of the federal parliament had to leave the Liberal Party, so-called Liberal caucus, and then later there was Mr. Johnston in his report apparently exonerated the individual, but the Liberal caucus has not taken that individual back. We're again, careers disrupted, people really becoming suspicious of each other, groups, suggestions that some organization might be under the influence, etc. Here's my point, key point. The source has never been identified. And the material that the really makes the headlines work is that information top marked, identified as top secret, has been referred to and cited by journalists who have a particular, frankly, have an agenda, let's put it that way. Clearly, the source has an agenda, or sources, because we do not know who they are. And here's the enigma. Here's Canada, the enigma wrapped in a mystery. Why, after all these months, where the subject is fairly straightforward, we're talking about someone involved in handling top secret material involving CSIS surveillance of Chinese Canadians and of the Chinese embassy, with specific individuals being named or referred to clearly so that anybody would know who they were, who's in intelligence or police work. They have not, CSIS said that this is wrong, that someone ought not to be, it's illegal, it's actually a crime to be passing top secret information to journalists. And I've said on the program before, this is not broad gauge sharing of a top secret. This is targeted, to use their favorite kind of word, particular journalists who they know will write in a particular way. I don't know if this is a one-way street or a two-way street, who's working with whom, but we're supposed to be, and everybody is, to this moment, treating all this as very soberly, without saying who is the source, because that source has violated the law, violated their oath of office. And if we are to believe that they're capable, it's an organization that can actually do efficient work, how come they cannot locate and identify, or at least indicate they have identified and are dealing with that person or group of people? That's why Canada, in my mind, to an outsider, would be look like a mystery. People should ask, how is it possible that someone is passing top secret information and damage is being done, and the leaders say this is wrong and shouldn't be happening? Well, then how come they can't find them? And two, why are we crediting this organization if it's not capable of, it looks to me like a rather simple job to figure it out. Meanwhile, allowing, everybody seems to be very excited about, oh, let's have hearings and let's have public this and public that. And they say, hey, this is all very important. Well, it actually isn't if you're not going to produce the evidence, and if you're not going to produce the individuals who wrongly, illegally circulated the information. So I think we ought to be a little more humble and say that seems to be something wrong with the intelligence service. And rather than say, oh, they're trying to tell us, some people go so far as to say the individual is a whistleblower. How would they know that? If you don't even know who you're talking about, there's no way of knowing whether this is a whistleblower or somebody involved in political mischief. For all I know, it could be foreign influence. All those things are possible. But the failure to start at point A means we'll always be off on a wrong foot and doing damage to the Canadians and their rights, because the germ in all of this talk is about limiting political activity and freedom of speech and association, which is supposed to be rather, taken as somewhat sacred signs of a working democracy. There isn't actually any enthusiasm for working democracy, because there is no editorial saying, how can it be that a CSIS source is still wandering around loose and they have passed top secret documents? So let's just underline that. And let's keep coming back to it. We will try to do that on the Taylor Report. We'll talk to some people. By the way, I just want to say, looking into all this, these matters, I do have a news story, and it's an old one, actually. This was before, I can't give you the date, but I got it from Canadian media, and I'll have to identify them in future time. I just have it in front of me. But this is what it says. This was a report written because there were some complaints some years back about CSIS, and this is what it says. A new report from the Federal Spy Watchdog says the Canadian Security Intelligence Service failed to adequately consider the potentially serious adverse effects on people and their families when using its powers to disrupt potential threats. the National Security and Intelligence Review Agency report also says the spy service, I'm glad they just say it, spy service, takes an overly narrow, that's quote, overly narrow approach when determining whether a judicial warrant is required for a particular threat disruption measure. And then it says, and this is really interesting too, 8 years ago, Parliament passed legislation allowing CSIS to go beyond its traditional role of gathering information about espionage and terrorism to actively derailing suspected schemes. We've talked about this previously on the show. Once you give that kind of power to a secret organization, you're going to have problems. And I would invite you to read Canadian history, look into the War Measures Act, but also the provocations when René Lévesque was the premier of Quebec. They went so far as putting a guy in his office who was an informer. But they also, in the RCMP, that was, I'm talking about organizations of this type, were given, I call it discretionary power, where acts of violence and barn burnings and explosions and such actually happened because they made them happen. And they had to be put on a shorter leash. But now we have a new outfit, and they doesn't seem to have a leash. And it doesn't seem to have a clue either, as I mentioned, because it can't even locate its own member working on one particular file. So we're supposed to, and then we're supposed to credit all their work, which I don't see the basis of that at all. But what is really makes us mysterious and interesting to the outside world is, how do we function? How does this happen? And why isn't there any media asking about this? Why is everybody so happy just to say, oh, this is disturbing? Somebody called a source, said something, forgetting that accusations don't mean anything unless they're going to be backed up. Now, and apropos of this, I was also looking at something that struck me and I want to know and I don't have the answer to this, but I was reading a new book by Michelle Wrong, and we've talked about it on the show before, called Do Not Disturb. It's her investigative reporting on how the RPF of Rwanda came into power and some of the crimes that they've been accused of outside their country. And along the way, she said, it's a very readable book, but she says that she's been working on the Rwanda file for a long time. And she says she knows journalists who actively helped the RPF. She said some did it for romantic reasons or notions, that they passed information, that they were couriers. This is heavy stuff if you actually think about it. Journalists who were, because the journalism on Rwanda has been notoriously bad, but she's talking about people who actively worked with them. And she claims, it's in the book, in one instance at least, she's aware of a journalist who's an RPF member. This is a Western journalist. This is not an African journalist and not a Rwandan. Now, it isn't the core of her story at all, but when you see an item like that, it needs to be raised, because we're in a society which claims to be all very interested in protection of people's rights, but also the journalists want to be very righteous in asking questions and doing investigations and getting to the bottom of things and all these wonderful things. And they also can be very demanding when they interview people, and they're really acting a role. And I guess most of them are on the up and up. But when she says something like that, it should set a little bell ringing. And apropos, I was thinking of Bernstein, who broke the big story of the so-called the Watergate. He was one of those who broke the story. He's done some interesting writing about journalists and irresponsible journalism. And by the way, when I talked about the Globe's treatment of the interference story, I think they're highly irresponsible. But here's what I found, taking this, I think, from Rolling Stone. The degree of collaboration frequently between journalists and intelligence has reached stunning levels. During the early decades of the Cold War, some journalists even became outright CIA assets. Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein, January 1977, 25,000-word article in Rolling Stone, was an extraordinarily, he wrote an extraordinarily detailed account of cooperation between the CIA and members of the press, and it provided key insights into that relationship. In some cases, the journalists, quotes, journalists, were actually full-time CIA employees masquerading as members of the Fourth Estate. But Bernstein also confirmed that some 400 bona fide American journalists had secretly carried out assignments for the CIA during the previous 25 years. He noted that journalists, quote, this is Bernstein talking, journalists provided a full range of clandestine services, from simple intelligence gathering to serving as go-betweens with spies in communist countries. Reporters shared their notebooks with the CIA. Editors shared their staffs. So I'm saying that goes on now. And I remember that there was, because of the great so-called Watergate crisis, after the Vietnam War, there was tremendous desire to try to get these kind of agencies under control. And there was a pledge made, and it was actually, I guess it was a result of legislation by a senator from Idaho, his name was Church, that, and the press organizations said they wanted this. They wanted a guarantee, or at least a legal promise or whatever, from the government that they would not place their agents inside the news agencies. And then time went by. Mr. Church passed away, and politics shifted in America. And one day, I watched a journalist who was asking a question of the Reagan administration, and he said, "Can you assure us that your intelligence agencies are not infiltrating media?" And they said, "We don't have to answer that. We're not going to answer." So, you know, this permits the public, in my view, I would like to know if the major media here have some kind of code of conduct, promise to their readers that they will not employ people who are actually double pretending to be one thing and actually working for another outfit. Intelligence, state bodies. It's time, in my view, to particularly with this current CSIS business, to ask, are the major media outlets in Canada, do they have that code, and are they strictly enforcing it? Because what we're watching with this mean-spirited and messy CSIS story should raise questions as to who's doing this And again, you better bring the source because it might help us. But nobody seems to be interested in that. But at any rate, I think I laid the foundation for a topic which we need to talk about. And we will do so more on the Taylor Report. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Take a break and we'll talk about all the issues.